This lecture, entitled The Ten Tests of Abraham of Avram, is dedicated to the memory of Ilui Nishmas Sora Bas Shmuel Abba, Aleha Shalom, Mrs. Sarah Kirzner, of blessed memory. In Western society, there's no greater praise than being called a hero. A hero being defined by the American Heritage Dictionary as, quote, a person noted for feats of courage or nobility or of purpose, especially one who has risked or sacrificed his or her life. In Greek mythology, the one who most personified the hero ideal was Heracles, or Hercules as he was known by the Romans. Beset by 12 arduous tasks or labors imposed by him by the Greek king Eurystheus, Hercules pushed himself beyond the normative limits of human courage and endurance and successfully completed them all. As is typical in Greek mythology, after completing these labors and many other great feats, Hercules died a tragic and untimely death. But according to legend, he was richly rewarded for his heroism and held the distinction of being the only man in Greek mythology to have made the full transition from mortal to immortal. The Hebrew equivalent of hero is gibor. Although the word gibor can be understood in the Greek sense, one who risks his life and overcomes formidable opposition in order to accomplish great heroic feats, similar to Hercules, the ideal gibor or hero in the Jewish tradition is defined in the Mishnah and Avos in the beginning of the fourth chapter as follows, Ezehu gibor hakovash yisro. Who is considered truly a gibor, a true hero, one who conquers or exerts control over his own personal inclinations or desires. In the words of King Solomon, Shlomo HaMelech, in Proverbs Mishle, this is in chapter 16, verse 32. Toiv erech apayim megibor, u'moishel baruchoy meloi chadir. He who is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he who rules his spirit than he who takes a city. Although the pages of Jewish history are replete with examples of such heroism, if one would have to choose one individual who personifies this ideal, the Jewish ideal of heroism, it would have to be Avram Avinu, our forefather Abraham. Not only did he have the courage of conviction to defy the belief system of his home, his nation, the entire world, and was willing to give up his life for his ideals, a subject we discussed in the previous lecture, but through much of his life he was faced with difficult tests, tests which challenged his beliefs and faith, tests where he battled his own personal inclinations, but nonetheless remained true to his ideals and never wavered. The heroism of Hercules may have inspired the Greeks, but it was the courage of Avram Avinu, our forefather Abraham, that not only inspired Jewry, but also laid the foundation for the profound relationship that God had with Avram and subsequently with his descendants. The story of Avram, Abraham, and his many tests, culminating with the Akedah, the binding of a son Yitzchok, is the subject of this lecture. The Mishnah in Avos, near the beginning of the fifth chapter, describes Avram's tests as follows. This is on your first page. It begins, our forefather, this is in the third Mishnah of the fifth chapter of Avos. Our forefather Avram, Abraham, was tested with 10 trials, and he withstood them all to show the degree of our forefather Avram's endearment to God. This is his endearment. Commenting on this, and commenting on the fact that even though Avram is mentioned earlier in the Mishnah, but at this point he's called Avram Avinu, our forefather Avram. The Tosus Yom Tov Lippman Heller comments as follows. For we merit and receive benefit due to the merit of Rome received by withstanding all of the trials. We merit this because of Avram. For that reason, the Tana, the author of the mission, refers to him here, and not when Avram was first mentioned, as being our forefather. In other words, because it's really we as the children benefit from this. This seems to me to be the correct explanation. That's why at this juncture he's called our forefather. Because everything that we have is through him. And it continues on, and he withstood all of them, these tests, for he did not harbor second thoughts about God's attributes. He didn't ask the question, how could God do this to me? That's what meant withstanding the test. What were these 10 tests? In the Midrashim, we actually find different versions of these tests. They're all very instructive. And for the most part, these Midrashim don't disagree about the tests themselves, but rather how they should be numbered. And we're going to go into detail about the tests. We're going to point out some of the differences, and towards the end of the lecture, we're going to summarize what those differences are. And first, we quote from the Ovis to Rabbi Nosson. This is in Perek Lamed Gimel, chapter 33. Our forefather Avram was tested with 10 trials, was found perfect in all of them. These are the tests. 2 in Lech Lecha, which would mean one leaving of his homeland, and the other experiencing a famine immediately after arriving there. As he was told that he was going to be, he's going to gain fame and fortune in Eretz Yisrael. As soon as he leaves his home and he comes to Eretz Yisrael, comes to Israel, and he faces this terrible famine. 2 with his children. I sending away Yishmo, it would seem. So that's one child is Yishmo. And the Kedis Yitzchak, the binding of Yitzchak. 2 with his wives. Now, his 2 wives and again 2 trials. Now, one was Sor was taken by the king, was really done on 2 occasions, but that seems to be counted as 1. And with Hogar. Now, it's not clear what the test with Hogar. On the surface, it would seem to be Hogar was sent away. We're going to see another explanation in the following Medrash. 1 with the war, says with the war of the kings. 1 with the covenant and vision of Bein HaBesorim. This is the covenant of the pieces where he was told his descendants would be enslaved and tormented. 1 with Ur Kasdim. In other words, he was thrown in the fiery furnace where he was willing to give up his life, a Kiddush Hashem, to sanctify God's name. 1 at the Bris Milah. This is the covenant of the circumcision. He was 99 years old. So according to these were the tests. If you count them up, says there are 10. It's good we have a mathematician here. Why so many tests? So that when our forefather Avram receives his reward, all of the nations of the world should say, there's one version, all of the angels. Says Avram is more worthy of receiving reward than all of us together, more than anyone who ever existed. Regarding him, is it stated in Ecclesiastes, go eat your bread with joy and drink your wine with a glad heart. Because you deserved it. But it would seem from this that the purpose of the tests was really that the world should recognize Avram, who he was. So we're going to see all other explanations as well, but just to keep this in mind. Now, the next source is the Medrash Tehillim, and this is Perek Yudches, this is Psalm 18. You know, as for God, his way is perfect, Hail Tom and Darka. And it continues, the word of the Lord is tried. He's a shield for all those who trust in him. This is a pasuk in Shmuel Beis in the second book of Samuel, chapter 22, verse 31. This verse is referring to our forefather Avram, for the Holy One, blessed be he, saw that he pulled himself after him, like he was attracted to God, and therefore chose him, and that's why he says, And that's why God chose Avraham, because Avraham made the effort of becoming close to God. He said to him, and this is God said to Avraham, I am the Almighty God, El Shaddai, walk before me and be perfect. So that said, his way is perfect, this is the idea of choosing God, and he expected of Avraham to be perfect. To trust. This is implicitly in God. The word of the Lord is tried. For God tried him with 10 trials. They are the following. We'll keep in mind how it compares to the last one. One was with a fiery furnace, as it says, I am the Lord who took you out from Ur Kasdim. Okay. That follows the previous one. Another was, leave your country, etc. Also falls. Two involve Sora being forcibly taken by Pharaoh, Paro, and Avimelech. The previous one only listed one. So this list is two. That makes four. Another was regarding Hagar, the Egyptian maidservant, whom he was told, please have relations with my maidservant. That makes five. In other words, according to this version, the test of Hagar is that he willingly, really God told him to listen to his wife. But he went and took her. It was a sacrifice on his part. He did it really to please his wife. But this is counted as the fifth. Remember, the previous one counted one with two with his two wives, one with his Hagar, but it's not clear is it referring to the taking or is it referring to sending out. Another was regarding Ishmael when he was told, cast out the slave and her son. That makes six. Another involved the war with the kings. As it says, he armed his trained servants. That makes seven. Another was regard to the midst of circumcision. As it says, every male child among you shall be circumcised. That makes eight. Another was regard to the covenant between the pieces, where he was shown the four kingdoms were destined to enslave his children. That makes nine. And finally, Akedah shall Yitzchak, the binding of Yitzchak, as it says, please take your only son, etc. That makes ten. If you notice, the famine is not mentioned. Again, evidently, according to this Medrash, the famine itself was not the test, but rather it set up the idea that he had to go down to Egypt where Sora was forcibly taken, and that was the test. And it continues on the Medrash, and he accepted them with fear and love and stood up like a warrior. And you see again the idea of warrior, the Jewish idea of warrior. What was his reward? He is a shield for all those who trust in him. As it says, I will shield you. The nations of the world ask, why was the Holy One, blessed be, especially fond of Avraham and saved him from the fiery furnace and delivered him from the kings and their multitudes and from all of the troubles that he experienced? The Holy One, blessed be, he said to them, behold, I'm going to sacrifice and show you, even if I tell him to take and sacrifice his son for my sake, he will listen to me. That is the reason that I protect him. He is a shield for all those who seek shelter with him, and the future his children will make the benediction in their prayers, Baruch Atah Hashem, Mogen Avraham, Blessed be Hashem, the shield of Abraham. We are shielded because we are the descendants of Avraham. Avraham was shielded, and we too, because we trust in Hashem. But again, we see a special, there's special stress on the importance that the nations of the world should appreciate who Avraham was and why Hashem chose Avraham. Of all of the Midrashim, the Medrash Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer goes into the greatest detail regarding the life and trials of Avraham. And this Medrash too has different versions of the 10 trials. It is quite detailed. But however, we're going to touch upon at least those details that give us a new picture of his life and his trials. And it continues, our forefather Avraham was tested with 10 trials and withstood them all. This is in the 26th chapter of the Medrash Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer. Now, you'll notice the first trial was not mentioned in the other lists. The first trial occurred when Avram was born. All the leaders and sorcerers of the kingdom wished to have him killed. Everyone, they saw a vision, some sort of a sign that he would cause tremendous trouble to them. Actually, he was a revolutionary. And he was forced to hide in his brother Horan's house for 13 years, which is, according to this medrash, it would come out that Horan was older than Avram, whereas in other sources it seems he was younger. In a closed area where he saw neither the sun nor the moon. After 13 years, he left Horan's house, able to speak in the holy tongue. He was disgusted with the so-called gods. He despised the idols. He only put his trust in the name of his creator. His motto was, "Fortunate is man who trusts in you." This, as you notice, is different than the other versions that we quoted before. From the Gemara, it seems he recognized God from the age of three. According to the Rambam, he was at the age of 40. So this story really does not exist in the other sources. But in any case, being raised as a child in such difficult circumstances, according to this version, was a trial. His second trial was that he was imprisoned for 10 years, three in Kusa, and we have, should be, just for 1 second. Yeah, there was an error in the original original text. It would have to be like seven in Kusa and three in Beit Dori, or vice versa. That's because there's a three, a son of seven. It's interesting. According to the Gemara, which we quoted in a previous lecture in Baba Basra and Sadi Aleph Amud Aleph 91a. Avram was imprisoned in Kusa, as it says here. It says and in Kardo, which is Kurdistan. If they're not in disagreement, then we have to say this Beit Dori is a town within Kurdistan, but it's not clear. After 10 years, they sent for him and brought him before Nimrod, who threw him into the fiery furnace. The King of Glory stretched out his right hand and saved him from the fiery furnace, as it says, "I'm the Lord who brought you out of Ur Kasdim." Okay, so the second trial is common to all of them. The third trial was his moving away from the house of his father and the land of his birth. We brought him to the city of Choron, where his father Terach and his mother, this is Asadoi, died. And just again, the name of his mother Asadoi in this medrash, you have to compare that again to the version in Baba Basra in 91a. Where the name of his mother is given Amsaloi, the daughter of Carnival. Moving is the most difficult thing for a person to do. What is the source regarding the trial of his moving? And God said to Avram, "Leave." And again, just to point out a discrepancy, a difference between this and the previous version, it seems he was told to leave. I mean, the leaving was his moving from the house and the land of his birth. And he's quoting the verse Lech Lecho. It seems the verse Lech Lecho was said to him while he was still in Ur Kasdim. This is really a subject of argumentation. When was Lech Lecho said to him? We quoted in the previous lecture a Medrash that it was said to him while he was in Choron. And that was the reason he left Choron. He traveled around, finally came to Eretz Yisrael. And that's where, while he was in Eretz Yisrael during that time, he got the vision of the Bris Bein HaBesorim, the covenant of the pieces, and he was 70 years old. And that's really based on the Medrash of the different Midrashim. One was the Seder Olam, which we quoted, that he was 70 years old. But Lech Lecho was said, according to other previous quoted sources, when he is already in Choron. It seemed from here, in the context, that he was told, really, while he was still in Ur Kasdim. There's a difficulty with this, just from a scholarly viewpoint, because it seems when Avram left Ur Kasdim, he had a mission. He was going to Eretz Canaan. He stopped in Choron and remained there. If he was told Lech Lecha, to go to the place, which seems to be an ambiguous place, then he wouldn't have had an idea of where to go. I mean, that's... But we partially discussed this in the previous lecture. But it would seem that he was originally told Lech Lecha, and he was not clear where to go. And he traveled, and finally was given direction. Where it says later, finally, when he left Choron and went to with a vision, with in mind, to go to Eretz Yisrael, that was really when he was 75, as we explained. This was really not the Lech Lecha. He came back, took care of his affairs, and finally left with all his belongings and all his entourage. But again, I just wanted to point out, it's instructive to go through this and just to point out again the differences. The following was a fourth trial. From the day that heaven and earth were created until the time of Avram, the Holy One, blessed be, had never brought about a famine. It first occurred at the time of Avram and only affected the land of Canaan. And if you'll just notice, you know, in the Rosh Hashanah davening, there you'll find that there's a, before Kedusha, there's a long piyut that said, they sit down for 10 minutes or so and they say this. And it brings the version, that piyut brings the version of the 10 tests, but based on this medrash. So, you know, you'll see, and you'll go and you'll look it through next year, and you'll see, and you'll compare it. It first occurred at the time of Avram, and only affected the land of Canaan. This was in order to test him and to bring him down to Egypt, as it says. There was a famine in the land, and Avram went down to Egypt. So it's really twofold. It's to bring him down to Egypt because he had another test there, and also to the actual test itself. How would he react under such circumstances? As we're going to explain in a future lecture, there was another function of his going down to Egypt. This is Maisa B'Simla Bonim, the acts of the forefathers were assigned for the descendants, that really he paved the way for the going down to Egypt of Yaakov. And his leaving, as we say, bore with it resemblances of of the Jews leaving Egypt, which he's going to touch upon now in this fifth trial. The fifth trial was that Sarah, his wife, was taken to be the wife of Paro, of Pharaoh. Does there exist a man on earth who would see his wife taken by another man and wouldn't tear his clothing out of grief? So Pharaoh, however, Paro, didn't come close to her. And what is the source that Sarah was taken by Paro, Pharaoh, to be his wife? And it quotes the verse, the princes of Pharaoh also saw her and praised her to Pharaoh, and the woman was taken to Pharaoh's palace. Now, the Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha comments on this and said, the night that our matriarch Sarah was taken was the night of the future holiday of Passover. The Holy One, blessed be He, brought on Paro, Pharaoh and his household tremendous plagues as a way of informing us that he would smite the people of his land. This is in the future. In other words, this was really a preview. Just like his going down to Egypt was a preview of Yaakov's going down to Egypt, what occurred that night was a preview of the events that would occur in the future. As it says, it continues on the Medrash, and the Lord plagued Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarah, Abram's wife. Now, in regards to Egypt, it is written, and the Lord said to Moses, to Moshe, yet will I bring one more plague upon Pharaoh. And as the Makas Bechoros is called plague. This is a Makkah. And upon Egypt, it says, afterwards he will let you go from here. When he shall let you go, he will certainly thrust you out from here altogether. This is in the beginning of the 11th chapter in Exodus. Were they plagues in the sense of leprosy? And there's, which is written, referred to as nega. Usually the word nega, as plague, is really usually refers to leprosy. We really should have used a different word. Behold, the oldest of Egypt were smitten. And why is it called nega, which really refers to a skin disease? You know, why was that word used? But it was used purposely. So, but the makas, means the heavy blows or afflictions, are compared to Nagoyim plagues, referred to leprosy. As they use the same word to give the context, because over there by Sora, it was a plague of leprosy. Using that same word is to show you the parallel. I mean, they were both terrible things, but using the same word was really to point out the parallel between them. Because this was a preview of what was going to occur. For that reason it says, and the Lord plagued Pharaoh, using the same words. So that's one notion of the Maisa of the Simul Abonah. What happened to our forefathers was reenacted later on by their descendants. There is, fascinatingly, it says there is another parallel here with another statement of Yeshua ben Korcha. Rabbi Shua ben Korcha said, Sora was the wife of Pharaoh. Out of his love for her, he took her as a wife. He didn't touch her, but he was going to. And he wrote in her marriage document all of his wealth in the form of silver, gold, slaves, and land, and wrote that she should be given the land of Goshen as a permanent possession. This is evidently he had in tradition. This is not related in scripture, but evidently there was a tradition to this effect. So that is why the children of Israel settled in the land of Goshen, the land of their matriarch Sarah. Now, it was, again, this was a mice of us. This was really deeded to her, as really became their land. He also wrote in the marriage document that she have Hogar, his daughter from his concubine, as a slave woman. What's the source that Hogar was a daughter of Pharaoh and his concubine? There's a question how to understand this. But it says, now Sarai, Avram's wife, bore him no children. This is about the thing of Yishmael. And she had a maidservant, an Egyptian whose name was Hogar. Evidently it belonged to her exclusively. Evidently there was a special relationship between her and Hogar. Generally, everything was a household. It belonged to both of them. It belonged to Avram. It didn't belong to her. But evidently it's hinting at the fact, because it was hers as a result of the marriage with Pharaoh. Then it continues on. Pharaoh woke up in the morning in a fright, for he had not gotten close to her, and sent for Avram. He told him, here is your wife, now take her back, and all that's written in the marriage document. Now, the wealth that he had was really the wealth given to Sarah. Don't stay in this land any longer, as it says, behold your wife, take her and go your way. And Pharaoh commanded his men to escort Avram to come to the land of Canaan. And again, this is Maisa Ovos, Simul Abonim, that they left Egypt and they went back to Canaan. Later, he dwelt in the land of Philistines with the sole intention of resting up there and continuing on his way. But everything was revealed before the Holy One, blessed be He. Abimelech sent for Sarah, and he thought to have sons through her. As it says, Abimelech, the king of Gor, sent and took Sora, and it goes, again, he suffered, this is because of his attempt to take Sora. But according to this version, like the version of Avos Rabbi Nosson, it links both the fact that Sora was taken by Paro, and Sora was taken by Abimelech, they put them together as one test. So we can just look at yourself. We'll go on. I'll continue on here on page 6. The sixth trial was when the kings came against him in order to kill him. So this again puts a new twist on the story. Generally, you read the story. They went to war in order to quell a rebellion. They had originally conquered the land of Canaan. The kings were required to give them tribute. They refused to give them tribute. They arranged a whole military campaign. Four kings came together. They conquered the land surrounding the area of Sodom. Finally, they came to Sodom and conquered that. It was only when Avram's nephew was taken that Avram was involved. According to this, which evidently was based on a tradition, they originally went to war because they wanted to get Avram. In other words, if it wouldn't be for Avram, they wouldn't have bothered. They looked at him, he was a was someone who was upsetting the old order, and they wanted to rid themselves of him. They said, let's first start with his brother's son, and afterwards with him. It was because of Lot, they took all of the possessions of Sodom and Amorah, as it says, they took Lot from his brother's son who lived in Sodom and his goods and departed. Now, this also, the next part of this Medrash also gives us a different view of the events. According to this Medrash, there's the one who told Avraham, is Viova HaPolit, the one who survived. So simply, you read this, for the word who survived the war. And according to the other Midrashim, this was Og, who was a giant, who his whole family had been wiped out. And he survived the war, and he came to tell Avram about Lot, but his behind, according to the Medrash, his kavona, what he had in mind, though, was that he felt for sure that Avram himself would be killed, and he would take Sora as his wife. That's the view of the other Midrashim. This Midrash has it differently. It's interesting. The one who told him was the angel Michoah. This is the archangel. Says Michoah, says Michael, related the events to Avram, as it says, and there came one who had escaped and told Avram, or Ivri, the Hebrew. Says Avram, so it starts with Michoah. Who is... What's the relationship of Michoah? Why is he called the one who had escaped? So it relates a tradition, and it seems to be that there, on the tradition, it seems to be in a, I believe it's really a Kabbalistic mystery. I believe it's really one of the Yesoides of Kabbalah here. It says Michoah has been the bearer of news from time immemorial, as it says, and it goes, curse not the king. This is from Kohelis, Ecclesiastes, chapter 10. Not even in your thought. Says, and curse not the rich. This is in your bedchamber. For a bird of the sky shall carry the voice. The bird of the sky, and that which has wings shall tell the matter. It's an allusion to this angel. In other words, a psychic would be able to know. There's a communication. Why is he referred to as the one who had escaped? And it brings the story from when the Holy One, blessedly, he brought down Samael, the Samach Mem, says Samael, and his daughter from his place of sanctity from heaven. There's the idea of the fallen angel. But according to this, this is Samael, there's a version of the fallen angel. And Samael grabbed onto the wing of Michoah to bring him down together with him. But the Holy One, blessed be, let him escape from his power. This is why Michoah is called the one who had escaped. This is evidently a Kabbalistic notion. Michoah represents chesed. Samael really represents din. I mean, the one who is the tempter, the one who represents the forces of negativity. But God's chesed is not sullied. At least it's part of the I think this is the nimshol. This is really the message here of this story. Regarding him, did Yecheskel and Ezekiel the prophet say, came to pass the 12th year of our exile in the 10th month on the 5th day of the month, the one who had escaped from Yerushalayim came to me saying, the city has fallen. And he's saying that it wasn't a human being, according to this version, it's actually an angel. It continues on. Avram got up early in the morning, took with him his three disciples, Onur, Eshkol, Mamre, and Eliezer, his servant, with them, and pursued them in two stages. The first stage was until they reached Don. And he pursued them to Don. It was there that the tzaddik tarried, for he was told there, this Rashi brings us in Chumash, you should know that in the place some of your progeny will worship Avodah Zorah, as it says, and it says about how they were... it relates a story that Don became a cult center in the time of the kings. There was Yerovam ben Nevat who had rebelled in the time of King Solomon's son Rehoboam, who created a northern kingdom of Israel, knew that the kingdom could not last unless it had its own center of worship, and created two centers, one in Dan in northern Israel and one in Bezalel in southern Israel. And they built these golden calves, which are representatives of angels. And the king took counsel and made two calves of gold and said to them, "It's too much for you to go to Jerusalem. Behold your gods, I mean the angels, O Israel, which brought you out of the land of Egypt." And he set one in Bezalel, in Bethel, and the other he placed in Dan. So Avram, he felt this, and that's why it's really mentioned in the Torah. It's really, again, a prediction of the future. And it goes on, and really you could be just some of this. He left his three disciples there and took his servant Eliezer, whose name has a numerical equivalent of 318. And he pursued them, because it says he took 318 servants. According to this Medrash, really he took Eliezer. Now, the Malbim learns it's really, there were other servants, but Eliezer was the chief one, and he was the equivalent of the 318. And he pursued them up until the left, means the north of Damascus, as it says, he divided himself against them. He and his servants by night defeated them, pursued them to Hovah, which is on the left side of Damascus. Regarding this, Shmuel HaKotna said, because the phrase, "and he divided the night," hints to the fact they left Egypt at the night in which he smote the firstborn of Egypt. That was the same night which Avram smote the kings together with their armies, as it says, by himself against them, he and his servants. So according to this, if this statement is in concert with the previous statement, then the war of the kings happened exactly 1 year, it would seem after the, at least 1 year after the story with Sarah being taken in. This is, as the wife of Pharaoh, which again, according to this Medrash, also happened on the night of Pesach. So again, it's this notion that the future has been prepared for us. Okay, you could look at yourself at towards the end of this. The seventh trial was related to the following prophecy. After these things, the words of the Lord came to, says Avram, in a vision, saying, "Fear not, Avram, I am your shield, and your reward will be great." God revealed himself to all of the prophets in a chazon, in a vision. To Avram, he revealed himself in a mara and chazon. Now, it's not clear, this Medrash does not make a distinction between the two. But it would seem to be that mara is a more intense or a clear vision than chazon. Yonsef in a mara, as it sees, then the Lord appeared by Yerah to him in the plain of Mamre. Yonsef in a chazon, as it says, after these things, the word of the Lord came to Avram in a vision, saying, and it says this vision that he had was common to the other prophets. Evidently, the Mara was not; it was unique to Avram. But as you're going to see, and again, I just want to touch upon this for the differences that we have in these midrashim and what other midrashim that we've come across before. And it says, "Is the Holy One blessed be said to Avram, you should know that my right hand will protect you wherever you go like a shield against punishment. I will give you a goodly reward to you and your children in this world and the next." And it says your reward will be great. It says, Rabbi said, it says, "The Holy One, blessed be he, took him outside on the night of the holiday of Passover." And again, because this all really happened Pesach time. This is right after the war. In his victory, he said to Avram, "Do you have the power to count all the hosts of the heaven?" He said, "Before, master of the universe, is there a finite number of your armies?" In other words, of all of the, it is impossible to count, in other words, all of the stars. He replied, "Because of their abundance, your seed will not be countable. As it says, so shall your seed be." Rabbi Eliezer said, "The Holy One, blessed be, he showed our forefather Avram four kingdoms as they ruled in their destruction. As it says, bring me three-year-old heifer." As you notice, that it seems that the Bris Bein HaBesorim, according to this Medrash, was a simple reading would seem to bear out, is a continuation of what the vision that was given to Avram right after the war. At the time of the war, he was at least 75, if not older. if this is the vision, then it would seem then even the prediction of your seed, you know, shall be enslaved for 400 years, would be strangers and enslaved and tormented for all of a period of 400 years, was told to him then, after the war, because this Medrash continues this on. According to this, to the Medrash, the Seder Olam, which we quoted in a previous lecture, though, that vision was really given before the vision of the Bris Bane Besorim, the vision of being enslaved. This was really as a part of the Lech Lecha. He left, according to which we previously quoted in a previous lecture, he left, it says Choron, when he was around 70, at least when the time he traveled from one place to another. Finally, he was told, here, I'm going to give you this land. And later on, he was given the vision of the Bris Bane Besorim, when he was 70 years old, and told, says, that what is going to happen to his progeny. The vision after the war happened many years after that. The Torah just happened to put them together, but really they did not occur, you know, in sequence. From here it would seem to be it's all one vision. So here, just to point out that this is different than, this Medrash is different than with the Seder Olam. It's just important to realize that Ramban, Rashi quotes the Seder Olam. But the Ramban, whose inclination is always to read the things that are in order, are truly in order, they come and are truly in order, he also, many of the other commentaries, understands, like this Medrash, that the Bris Bane Besorim was given to Avram when he was at least 75 years old. But I just want to point this out. You should appreciate, you know, the differences. And again, because of the time, says you could look at this. You could really look yourself. Says one interesting thing, at least according to our text, you know, the version that we have, is we've stated in the previous lecture that the vision of the Bris Bane Besorim was a vision. One was how will Jews merit to be worthy of this covenant, so they should expiate their sins through the karbonos, through the sacrifices. And there was an image of these animals were sacrifices. And as the Gemara says, in the time we no longer have the sacrifices, the study of the sacrifices is a certain equivalent to the actual sacrifices. We also quoted a different source that these animals were really a symbol of the nations who would subjugate us. And we quoted this in the last lecture. This is the approach this Medrash takes, this Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer. But it says, according to one interpretation, that one of the birds, you know, that were taken, the tor, is really, it was a bird, but it's also a hint that the word tor in Aramaic means a bull. And there's a hint by using that, that really it refers to, again, those that would subjugate us. This mighty nation. So normally you would say, well, the mighty nation is referring to Edom. And it would fit in because it's really the twin, it's two birds. In a sense, they really came, Edom is from Esau. He had two sons, one went one way, the other went the other way. According to this Medrash here, it really is a reference to Yishmael. You notice, and the turtle dove Tor refers to the children of Yishmael, which is interesting. From a scholarly viewpoint, and we're going to see another problem with this Medrash, from a scholarly viewpoint, either you'd say that this part of the Medrash was written after Yishmael came into prominence. Because after all, during the period of the Tanoim listed here, the Yishmaelim, these were a very weak nation. The Arabs even had the Nabataeans in the south of Israel. a relatively small, minor power. That they should be a power to subjugate the Jews only happens after the death of Muhammad. Really, he says, under the Caliph Umar, who conquered Israel. And it was from that time on that the Arabs, the Ishmaelim, had a presence there, a real presence, and they really subjugated a large part of Jewry. So either, according to this, either this part was written later, or really this was the Ruach HaKodesh that they saw, the Ishmael that really, they saw that it would become a power in the future, even though it really was nothing then. In a certain sense, it makes sense. There's such a stress put on Yishmael and all of his, of the Nesi'im, all of his children who became these princes. And the Torah speaks of them, and they're a relatively minor power. When the Torah was given for sure, and even during the time, up until the time of the Midrashim, was a minor power. Yishmael became a major power in the time of the Gaonim, the 600s, in the 636. Well, the Midrashim would be in the time of the Tanoim and Amoraim. And this is the later period of the Gaonic period. And yet Yishmael is mentioned as a major power that would subjugate Jewry in the same way we speak about Bovel subjugating Jewry, Babylon or Persia or Greece, which we have the majority of the Jews or a very large minority of the Jews in terms of the Greeks. And the Romans, for sure, a very large part of Jewry were under Roman rule. And here we say Yishmael. So it seemed to be that it's really a prophecy of when Yishmael would be a major prophet. Either that or this part was written later, which is a question of the scholars. A fascinating thing, and again, I don't, because of the time, I'd like just to touch upon, on page 8, and this thing you could look at this is yourself. I just want to touch upon those parts of the Midrashim that are different than we would normally understand or other sources which we've studied in the past. On page 8, around 10 lines from the top or so, there's where Belozer ben Azariah said, this was the vision of that there was a bird of prey that came to go on these on the carcasses. And we said in the previous lecture, we said that it's really symbolizes the David HaMelech. This is quotes here. Wanted to destroy all of the enemies of the Jews, and he was not given the permission to do so. And it says, when the sun came out from the east, Avram was sitting and waving them away from the headscarf, so the bird of prey should not take hold of them until the time the raven comes. Evidently, this is a time they will truly be destroyed. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah said, from here one can infer that the four kingdoms will only dominate for a period of a day, which is measured as a day of the Holy One, blessed be He, which would be 1,000 years. So this would seem to be a prediction that from the beginning of subjugation from the Babylonians till the very end would be 1,000 years. Of course, from hindsight, we see much more than 1,000 years has occurred. But when Blessed Ben Azariah said this, it was in the middle of 1,000 years. But he viewed, at least his interpretation was, it was just going to be 1,000 years.
Each 1,000 years?
No, the whole period. The four kingdoms. It would seem so. I mean, we know just from Babylon did not dominate us for 1,000 years, and nor did the Persians. It would seem to be the sum total of all of them would be 1,000 years. Rabbi Elazar ben Aruch said to him, your words are certainly correct, as it says, and he has made me desolate and faint all day. Again, the word of day. This is the exception of 2/3 of an hour. The proof is by the fact that when the sun is inclined towards the west, it was about to set. 2/3 of an hour before its light becomes dim without brightness. Similarly, before the raven comes, the light of Israel will rejoice, as it says, and it shall be one day which shall be known to the Lord, not day nor night, but it shall come to pass that at evening time there shall be light. He looks at this as a passage in Zechariah, which is really referring to the end of this period of subjugation. it would just seem, you know, for just reading this from a scholarly viewpoint, that this Medrash was edited, was put together before the 1,000 years were up. Because it would just be strange that if this would be, as some scholars maintain, the Medrash came its final form in the Gaonic period after the 1,000 years were up. It would be difficult for them to include it. So it seemed to be that this Medrash was put together before the Gaonic period. According to there's a question about the dating, but at least according to the dating of the the traditional dating based on the Seder Olam, the destruction of the first temple occurred in the year 421 before the Common Era. According to the standard dating, it occurred 586 years before the Common Era. According to the Seder Olam, 421 years before the Common Era. Before that, there were some 18 years that the Jewry was under Babylonian sway. It had to give tribute to the Babylonians for 18 years even before that. But even if we counted from 421, so we would finish the period of 1,000 years in the year 580 or so. You know, and if we count even before, so it would be less. So that's in the period of Rabbanan Sabaroi, and that's before the Gaonic period. So Muhammad says the conquest of the Muslims occurred in the year 636. So 1,000 years, and we have to give time for this 2/3 of an hour even before that. So it seemed to be that it was really edited. It was edited before. I mean, one would think it would be difficult that they would edit, you know, and clearly that's not true. So evidently it was really came to its form really before this period. And it really then gives us pause that why Yishmol is mentioned. This really seems to be prophetic. I just wanted to make that point. You can really look on your own, says the... We'll go on now. The eighth child was when Avram was 99 years old. This is on page 9. I just like just to sub. Well, you can look at it yourself. I just want to summarize this, which was comes out that this also is different than other midrashim. According to this medrash, the time of the circumcision of Avram happened on the 10th of Tishrei, which were destined to become Yom Kippur. And this is the Be'etzem HaYom HaZeh, the phrase in that self-same day, which is used in the circumcision, is in the Bris Milah, is used in conjunction with Yom Kippur. And according to this Medrash, it happened on that day. It also, according to this Medrash, which is different than other midrashim, is if you see it's 5-6 lines from the top here. Rabbi Gamliel said, Avram sent for Shem, the son of Noach. This is Malki Tzedek Melch Sholem, who was the Kohen Lekel Elyon, the high priest of the high God. And he circumcised the foreskin of Yishmol, his son. As it says, that it was Avram circumcised and Yishmol, his son. As he did it, They both, in other words, Shem did the circumcision on Avram and Yishmol. But it was done by a Kohen. And it wasn't, as the other Midrashim have it, Avram himself did it, or Hashem helped him do it. But here it was, that it was done by a Kohen, and it was done, this is according to this, is actually was done in the place of the Mizbeach. Actually, it was done in Yerushalayim, according to this. So, and it says, every Yom Kippur, Hashem sees the blood, so to speak. Figuratively, sees that blood, and that's the schus, the merit of the Bris Milah is the one that stands is in our good stead to protect us in Yom Kippur. Again, because it's fascinating, you could look on your own. You could look at the rest of this medrash. On page 11, we have the ninth trial. This is centering on the following. Yishmael was born with the predilections to use a bow and grew up using a bow. As it says, as later on in his life, and God was with the lad, he grew and lived in the wilderness and became an archer. As a child, the Medrash says, he would take a bow and arrows and shoot them at targets, at literally corners. One day he saw Yitzchak sitting alone and he aimed and shot an arrow to kill him. Because he figured, listen, he's the competition. Saw witnesses and told Avram. She told him, Yishmael did this and this to Yitzchak. Get up and write over to Yitzchak all that the Holy One blessed be swore unto you and your seed, for the son of this maidservant shall not inherit together with my son with Yitzchak. And it continues on here, just skipping. It says, Yehuda ben Tema said, Sora said to Avram, write a divorce document to this maidservant, send her away from me and my son Yitzchak, from this world and from the next. And it says, of all of the evils that came upon Avram in his eyes, this was the very worst. Rabbi Yehuda said, the Holy One blessed be revealed himself to him and said to him, Avram, don't you know that from the very womb of her mother, Sora was the woman destined to be your wife. She's your friend, the woman of your covenant. Sora is not called a maidservant, but rather she's referred to as your wife. Hagar is not called your wife, but rather your maidservant. All that Sora said, she related in all truth. Let it not be grievous in your sight. And then Avram got up early in the morning and wrote a divorce document and gave it to Hagar, sent her and her son away from him, and from Yitzchak's son, from this world and from the next. And he was written off, so to speak. And it goes on, you could read yourself the details of what occurred. The ultimate of all tests, of course, was the Akedah, the binding of Avram's son Yitzchak. The Torah introduces this test with the following. So it came to on page 12. It came to pass after these things that God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham said, behold, here I am. Take now your son, your only son, Isaac Yitzchak, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there for a burnt offering upon one of the mountains which I tell you. This is the beginning of the Akedah. The Malbim, in his commentary to these verses, explains the nature of these tests and why it was so important for Avram to undergo them. We had touched upon from the beginning of the lecture the two midrashim that said there was a message to mankind as a whole, that they should see what kind of a person Avram was. The Malbim, however, reveals yet additional aspects of the importance of these tests. And this, starting on page 12. And it came to pass after these things that God tested Avram. So he first learns, and we're going to say Medrash learns like this as well, that really all of these things and the test refers to the previous nine tests. This is referring to all of these things which were related in regards to Avram, for all of them were tests. And now he goes on to explain there's a distinction between the word nisoyon, trial, and the term bechina, which we translate as examination. An examination, bechina, is used to test whether something contains, was naturally supposed to. A teacher gives a student a bechina, an examination, because he expects normally the student should know so this material, and wants to make sure that the student really knows what it's supposed to. For instance, one would examine bochen gold to test whether it's pure gold or an alloy. You expect gold to have certain features, is this true gold or not? That's the bechina. One would make a trial, nisoyan, however, using that term, to test whether something has a certain unknown natural quality. For instance, it says whether gold has a property of magnetism, which of course it doesn't. But as a researcher, research would be a nisoyon. You want to see that if a of an organism or of a material has properties that are unknown, but you want to test it. That's in the soya. Similarly, for a person, examination bechina would be to test whether the person has the kind of relationship with God which would be proper and expected for most people. That would be a bechina. A trial in the soya would be to test whether the person remains steadfast in his righteousness in areas which are above that which is normally expected of flesh and blood. There's no definite limit of trials. Avram was tested on 10 occasions. Each one more difficult than the preceding one, as it says in the Medrash, you have given a banner, nais, to those who fear you, that may be displayed because of the truth. By the use of the same word for banner and for trial, you are essentially saying trial after trial is the equivalent of banner after banner, like you're waving a flag. He was tried in order to raise him high like a mast of a ship. According to this explanation, one can understand the sentence to read, it came to pass after these things, after God had tested Avraham with 9 tests, that God said to him, Avraham, this final test. This last trial tested Avraham an area which is above and beyond normative human behavior. That's the first shot in the Malbim. Or alternately, which this is the second one, is how one normally understands this. One could say that the words God tested Avraham simply refers to this last test alone, as a commandment given to him was never meant to be fulfilled and was only a test. For after that which happened previous to this, this is where Avraham rose to his trial one level after another, he came to test him with the greatest of all trials. As after these things, he finally gave him the real ultimate test. So the test is referring to this last test. For with this, it became evident the magnitude of Avram's superhuman fear and love that he harbored for God. That's one. Now, he defines, it was a question how to read, to understand the verse, and he defined what a test is. And the Malbim continues on, behold, a test, Nisoyan, can ultimately be for the purpose of informing the tester, for the benefit of the one who is being tested, or fulfilling the needs of those viewing the test. In this instance, it was for all three, as evident from the Medrash, which gives 3 different analogies for this test. The first analogy is that of a flax merchant, who knows that he has superior flax. He pounds on his flax, which is for the benefit of the tested, in order to improve and correct it. In other words, there is a test which one being tested benefits from. The second analogy is to an ox of superior strength. The owner puts a heavy yoke upon the animal for the benefit of the owner and the fulfillment of his task, in order to test the limits of his animal's ability. So this is more like the test of the one who wants to test if gold has magnetism. You're going through various tests to see the outer limits of the The third analogy is the one whose earthenware jars were of fine quality. He bangs on them for the benefit of the buyers and onlookers in order for them to see the merchandise is of good quality. Now he goes on, which is really, this is a fascinating, time really doesn't allow this. He goes into a fascinating study of what was the, assuming that it's for, and he says it's for all three. So it's assuming it's for the tester. So when normally a tester makes a test, he really doesn't know what the outcome is going to be. He has no idea. That's why he's making the test. But for God, what does it mean that he's going to gain knowledge that he didn't have before? He's going to the assumption that God knows everything. And he knows how Avraham is going to perform. So how is it for the test? But he agrees from various sources that we find at least the Torah describes it in a sense that God gains new knowledge. Well, wait a minute, how could he gain new knowledge? So His answer, and you really have to see this yourself, is really part of the question of the Rambam's question about free will and God's knowledge. If God knows everything, So how are we free to make decisions? And he touches upon this. But ultimately he says the following, which is a Kabbalistic notion, which is an important idea. There is God as God himself. This is the Ein Sof. This is God who is without limit. We have no connection to that. That's Hashem, of course. But we can only relate to God as he relates to us in this world. As he relates to us in this world, in that relationship, he is gaining new knowledge of us in terms of his relationship. So all of the things that he knows is because he doesn't act upon the knowledge that he has of himself. He acts upon knowledge that he gains as history is progressing. And this is, you see, this is really the thrust of what the Malbim said. It's really, if one doesn't understand God and his knowledge, it's really not an answer. But basically he says he's working on two levels. And on the level of how he interplays with us, on that level, says he gains new knowledge. And you have to see this inside, look yourself. And of course, then he explains that the Akedah really was for the benefit of Avram himself. One grows through the process. But he says also as a benefit of mankind. So we explained before it's for the benefit of mankind in terms of now that they have a greater appreciation of Avram. But he adds from the Abar Benel two other things that they gained through this. And so we're on the bottom of page 14. And it says, and likewise, this is in the middle, for the benefit of the viewers, so they would realize the heights reached through prophecy and its truth. For if Avram had harbored any doubts regarding the truth of prophecy, he wouldn't have committed such an act to sacrifice his son. And this is really specific, of course, to the last. That which is for the nations as a whole, well, that's all of the tests. But specific to this final test was when, see, the clarity of his prophecy, he had no doubts. In addition, the truth regarding the belief in the survival of the soul after death became clear to the entire world. Avram would have never performed such an act unless he was fully convinced that the life of the body is considered utterly insignificant in comparison to eternal life. Rabbi Yitzchak Bar Benel writes at length. Because otherwise it would really make no sense to sacrifice if he would be totally be exterminated in the process. I'd like to conclude this section with the account of the Akedah given by the Medrash Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, because again, because of the various points, the things we learned from this. But before I do, just briefly, I would like to summarize what we learned up until this point, because we covered an awful lot of material. We studied three of the various versions of the 10 tests. There are more, which we didn't touch upon, but I wanted to limit to the most well-known Midrashim. All of the three which we studied include in their list the test of Ur Kasdim. Right? This is the furnace in which Avram was thrown for refusing to worship other gods. So that's one. They also include the test of leaving his homeland, Lech Lecha, that's two. The war of the kings, that's three. The Bris Bein HaBesorim, when Avram was shown the future suffering of his descendants, that's four. The circumcision at the age of 99, that's five. The Akedah, the binding attempted sacrifice of Yitzhak, that's six. With these six, the aforementioned Midrashim are in complete agreement. The three lists which we study also include Soras being taken, that's seven. But whereas Ovis de Rabbi Nosson and Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer count for being taken first by Paro and then by Abimelech, the king of the Plishtim of the Philistines, as being, says, only one prolonged test, the Medrash Tehillim in Psalm 18 counts them as two. So there's one discrepancy. Midrashim also count the divorce of Hagar and the sending away of Yishmael as at least one test, which makes it eight, in which they are in agreement. The Ovis Rabbi Nosna recounts the test of Hagar and Yishmael as being two tests. On the surface, we pointed out before, the test of Hagar would seem to refer to Hagar's being sent away, but perhaps Ovis Reb Nosson is in agreement with the Medrash Tehillim, which counts Avram's initial marriage with Hagar as a separate test. The Pirkei Rabbi Elias, however, does not count Avram's marriage with Hagar as a test, nor does it count the sending away of Hagar and Yishmael as being separate tests. It counts those two as being one. Another area of disagreement is the famine, which Avram experienced as soon as he came to the land of Canaan. Ovis, Rabbi Nos, and Pirkei Rabbi Elias are counted in their list of tests. The Medrash Tehillim does not. And finally, the Medrash Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer uniquely retells the story of Avram being hidden for 13 years as the first of the tests. None of the others do so. Is there any other recounting of this story, except in this source. Now, after this, we related those Midrashim. We quoted the Malbim's commentary as to the threefold importance of the tests. One, determining Hashem's relationship with Avram. Ato yadati ki yirei elokim. I know now that you are God-fearing. Avram's metamorphosis as a result of the tests. He grew because of these tests. And three, in its effect upon mankind and their view of Avram, and also how the Barbanel says about the role of prophecy, that he was convinced Avram would have never done this to sacrifice his son, and he was totally convinced says that it was true, and also by the idea of life after death. This is what we touched upon. Now I'd like to go through the last minutes of the class through the Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer's account of the Akedah. The tenth test is described in the Torah in the following manner. Came to pass after these things that God tested Avram. In other words, he tested him time and time again to know what was in his heart and whether he'd be able to arise and observe the commandments of the Torah or not. In other words, he says that God tests Avram like the first explanation shot in the Malbim means all the things, all these nine things referred to Elohim Nisus Avram. Thus he had already tested him, and now this is the final of these tests. In addition, the Torah was given in order that Avram observe its commandments. And as he had a prophecy of what the Torah would be, because Avram, as it says, because Avram obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws, that he was granted all of these blessings. Immediately prior to this, Yishmael had left the wilderness. This really sets the tone, and to visit our forefather Avram. So he made a visit. He happened to come just at this moment. Rabbi Yehuda says that very night, the Holy One, blessed be, he appeared to him and says, Avram, take your son. So he figured, who knows which son, maybe it's the one that just came. Avram took pity on Yishmael and said to him, Master of the universe, which son are you referring to? The uncircumcised son? It doesn't mean truly, he had a circumcision, Yishmael. But he meant to say the one who is not, the one part of the covenant of circumcision, or the circumcised one. He replied, your only son, Avram responded, this is the only son of his mother and the only son of the others, of his mother. Then he said, the son which you love. And Avram answered, I love both of them. He then told him, Yitzchak, and bring him up as a burnt offering. Avram then said, Master of the universe, which mountain do you tell me? Says, wherever you see my glory standing and waiting for you, there you will say, this is the mountain of Moriah. Because he says, upon one of the mountains which I tell you, the land was called Eretz Moriah. He says, but on which mountain it will be, I'll show you. Avram arose early in the morning, took Eliezer's servant, and his son Yitzchak, and saddled the donkey. And it goes on to say, this medrash, it's the same donkey, which the Maharal comments on, which Moses rode on, which Mashiach will ride on. And it's a question, I don't understand this. It's meant to be said literally or it's figuratively. It goes on, you can look at it, it goes on to the details of this. But on page 17, it explains that the altar that he built in that place was actually the same altar that Noah had made his sacrifices before him, or the Mikayim had brought sacrifices. This place was meant from time immemorial to be the place of offering. The Medrash also says that he brought with him not only the fire and the wood, but he brought, since there's going to be a burnt offering, and normally a burnt offering of an animal comes with a flour offering and also a wine offering. And he brought that as well, which is not in the text. Again, it says that you could, really on your own, you can see that the various, you know, thing of this Medrash, the Medrash continues on, which is an important idea. Again, this is to be understood Kabbalistically, that this, the, after he had, he was ready to sacrifice him, he had bound him. He bound him really at Yitzhak's suggestion. And he was finally ready to do so, and at the last moment, the knife was on the neck of Yitzhak, and Hashem says, don't. The Malach came down, an angel, says, don't do this. And in its stead, there appeared, after he had come up, there appeared this ram, which had been specially prepared, and that ram was in the place of Yitzhak. This Medrash, though, does say, interesting enough, at the point where the knife was on his neck, Yitzhak died on his own beforehand. His soul left him. And when he was told not to touch him, the soul came back to Yitzhak, and Yitzhak rose like by Tchias HaMesim, like the resurrection of the dead. And Avram understood at that point how the resurrection will occur. And he said, Boruch Mechaye Mesim, who resurrects the dead. That blessing that we say is really a rewording of the blessing that Avram originally said. It came through Yitzchak. The ram, the Medrash goes is that all of the parts of this ram were used Kabbalistically, figuratively, says for various roles in history, which basically is saying all that occurred to the Jews occurred through the merit of this ram. A ram has two horns. The two horns were used, figuratively were used, to sound the shofar on the two peak moments of history because of what occurred at the Akedah. One was at Matan Torah, when the Torah was given, and one was when Mashiach will come. The left one is by Matan Torah. The right one was when the Torah, when Mashiach will come, that's the Kaaba shofar Godol, if ever seen. The great shofar, that's the right shofar. Again, basically it's saying all that occurs through this. And we hear the sound of that, what it would have been from that shofar. Again, so there's fascinating details in this Medrash, but these are, I think, the points I'd like to share with you. But it's important, again, we speak about Avram and his tests, and the ultimate tests. It's really because, basically, of the tests of the Bris Bein HaBesorim, that's through the covenant of the pieces, the test of the circumcision, and the test of the Akedah, that we descendants have what we have. And like, this is really the last part of this lecture here, on page 18. And Avram was 99 years old, because this is the Bris Milah. And the Lord appeared to Avram and said to him, I am the Almighty God, Kel Shakai, walk before me and be perfect. I will make my covenant between me and you and multiply you exceedingly. Avram fell on his face, and God talked with him, saying, as for me, behold, my covenant is with you, and you shall be a father of many nations. As it's explained in the Medrash before, that he fell on his face. At that point, says he was uncircumcised, and the prophecy was so intense that he could not, that what he had previously experienced, he couldn't experience. He had to fall on his face. Later on, after he had the Bris Milah, he was able to have that same experience standing up. And he's giving him this test, says, behold, you shall be a father of many nations. Neither shall your name anymore be called Avram, but your name shall be called Avraham, for a father of many nations have I made you. And I will make you exceedingly fruitful. I will Make nations of you, and kings shall come out of you, and I will establish my covenant between me and you and your seed after you and their generation for an everlasting covenant to be God to you and to your seed after you. And look at the underline, and I will give to you and your seed after you the land where you are a stranger, all of the land of Canaan. It seems really to add more of the land of Canaan. And it seemed to me that this really includes even the land of the Philistines. For an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. This is the wording of the Bris Milah. At the Akedah, at the end of the binding, it says, and he said, by myself have I sworn, said the Lord, for because you have done this thing, and have not withheld your son, your only son, that in blessing I will bless you, and it's like I will truly bless you, and in multiplying I will multiply. There's a question about the redundancy here. Rashi brings a medrash, it refers to both a blessing to Avram and to Yitzchak. Multiply your seed as the stars of the heaven, as the sand which is upon the seashore, which is meant to be understood that the stars, they will be great luminaries. The quality of each of them will be like a star. And the idea of sand, you understand that even though the surf is constantly pounding the seashore remains. And it really remains as a block against the sea. That's how you the Jews will survive. And your seed shall possess the gates of his enemies, and your seed shall all of the nations of the earth be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice, referring to listening to the commandment of the Akedah, of the prophecy of Akedah. Later on, this is now in chapter 22. In other words, the Bris Milah is in chapter 17. The Akedah, the bindings in chapter 22 of Genesis. Later on, in Parshas Toldos, in chapter 26, it's written, and there was a famine in the land besides the first famine that was in the days of Abraham of Avram, and Yitzhak went to Abimelech, king of the Plishtim, the Philistines, to Gerar. And the Lord appeared to him and said, do not go down to Egypt. Live in the land of which I will tell you. Sojourn in this land, and I will be with you and will bless you. For to you and to your seed I will give all of these countries, yes, including the land of the Philistines, and I will perform the oath which I swore to Avram your father. And I will make your seed multiply as the stars of the heaven, which is seen, that was referred to, you know, as a bris. He was told before in a vision after the War of the Kings. But as a oath, this was, as we, on top of the page here of 19, happened in the wake of the Akedah. And I will give to you, you see, all of these countries, that was the Bris Milah. And in your seed shall all the nations be blessed. Again, that was the Akedah, right? Because Avram obeyed my voice, that was the Akedah, right? This was the listening to the Akedah. And kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. This would be referring to the Bris Milah, which explained the previous lecture, that when he was told, walk before me and be perfect, walk before me and keep the Torah. And we said, we quote before in the Medrash and in Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, he was given the Torah before. And he kept the Torah before it was given. And this was really seems to be one of the conditions of the Bris Milah. It was because he kept all of this, that this was given. We who keep all of this, we continue this on. And it's interesting, there's a Parsha in the Torah, and in the Sefer Dvarim, Parsha's Ekev. The same word of Ekev is used here. And therefore it shall come to pass, this is in Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 12, if you heed to these judgments and keep and do them, the Lord your God shall keep with you the covenant and the mercy which he swore to your fathers. Evidently, it was given to them. We have to keep our part of the bargain, just like Avram, and also keep all the mitzvahs. So, it was given, just to summarize, all of this was given because Avram was such an unusual person. He was the true Gibor, not the Hercules with the 12 tests, but Avram with the 10 tests. And because of them, there was a unique covenant, not only to Avram, but to his children after him. You know, it's unique. You know, in Greek mythology, we never have this idea of a relationship of a nation of children after. This is unique. This is the test of Avram. If we walk in his footsteps and keep, basically, this is what to follow, so we will enjoy the fruits of all that Avram planted. Now, are there any questions?
A couple of questions. Since the way the Torah is written that the Akedah occurred only in the witness of Avram and his son Yitzchak, and the two lads were, of course, it was written down, but how does it transfer to be known to all the nations? And was there a like that Avram and Yitzchak?
Yeah. So the question is, how would all the nations know? And again, you know, they'll say, well, you made it up. That's a nice story, but you just made it up. It seems that humanity as a whole didn't doubt, I mean, basically the veracity of the Torah. At least, you know, the Torah was given. This is the idea of that the Jews left Egypt in a miraculous way, that they experienced the Matan Torah, the Ten Commandments, that it was a document that was written at the time when it occurred, was something which humanity did not doubt as a whole, and they believed it. It was really only in recent history. That there was really a doubt of the basic historicity. Because when in the time of the Talmud, when they would speak about apokursim, heretics, they didn't doubt the basic historicity, nor did they doubt that Moses was at least wrote down, was the scribe of the Torah. Their question was, did Moses write some of it down on his own? He is just like Korach had claimed that. That some of it was really a fabrication of Moshe's, and that which the Gemara says that anyone who doubts the divine mandate of writing the Torah is an apokeres. But the apokeres would say, no, there was no divine mandate, at least some of this. But no one doubted that he wrote it, and the age of the document. So I don't believe this as a whole. Because of that, they didn't doubt the basic storyline. But I don't think beliefs is that, at least from the time the Torah was given, that they doubted, as humanity as a whole, doubted the veracity of the basic story.
So even the Greeks, the pagans, and the Romans, with all their different Avodah Zarahs and stuff, you say at that point in history, it was obviously after the Torah was given, but at that point in history, they also brought that into their culture that this occurred?
Well, it wasn't from their forefathers. They didn't record, but they would see this. They would say, yeah. I mean, they wouldn't doubt the historicity of it. You had a very unusual forefather. You had a very unusual grandfather. It's not for us, but so in that sense, they would, if they would see that, they would appreciate the uniqueness of the Jews and why they're worthy of a special place. It's an interesting point. Just 2 points. First of all, what was the role of Yishmael there? And the fact is that according to the Quran, in the Muslim version, it was Yishmael and not Yitzchak. In a certain sense, one question answers the other. You know, of sorts. We discussed before, and it's very interesting, but in terms of the dating, at least the final editing of this Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, when the mention of Yishmael, was this added later, or this was really prophetic? But one sees the Torah that there's a special role for Yishmael. There's a great length about him, a lot said about him and his progeny. Evidently, there was something meant for him. And later on, we find in history, much later in history, that they have an inordinate place in history. Like a full sixth of mankind has adopted the religion of Yishmael. A third of mankind has adopted the religion of Rome, of in some form, you know, which Chazal trace to Edom, to Esau. So these two people really now make up, and as the people they influence, make up half of humanity. I mean, there's really something to be said here. And they both of them view themselves as the heirs of Avram. You know, that they come from, they're related in some way from Avram. The fact, you know, the Rambam, at the very end of his work, at the end of Hilchos Melachim, when he speaks about Mashiach, that there's a line which ends off his work, which has been excised, it was censored. And it describes as the purpose of why Christianity and Islam had such success. And his theory is that it's really to pave the way for Mashiach. It's really to make the world from a pagan world to a monotheistic world, which they did. And many of the ideas that are associated with Jewry and are really part and parcel of their religion. So they really have an important place to play. If the Muslims had not viewed themselves originally, early on, as a special, as Yishmael, they view as their ancestor, having a special place in Avram's life, to the extent that he was the one commanded to sacrifice him. If they didn't view in their view, if they didn't have that, they probably would not have had that fervor to go on to accept this and to missionize and to conquer so much of the world. It's really because they had this notion. So it's interesting that perhaps the fact that Yishmael was there, at least got pretty close to this, maybe had an impact on him that he viewed this. Who knows? Maybe when he told over the story, it was a little different. You know, but it could be that it was really important for him to be part of this, to have that impact on him, that really, even though they were the Arabs had a very minor role in history, but after the death of Muhammad and the conquest that began, really from the caliphs, those his successors, that they first consolidated the whole of all of Saudi Arabia, and then the time of Umar, they went and conquered Egypt and Israel, and eventually most of the Byzantine Empire, and they stretched all the way to India, and later on they eventually went on to Indonesia. And they went from one end, says on the Pacific, in Tunisia, and the other way, they went until they were displaced. They went North Africa and to Spain. They had a tremendous empire. And maybe part of it was that he had something to do with this Akedah. Okay, a good tovah.